been waiting for you.
To this latest episode of Black Hole Cinema. Today it's
EastEnders.
Yeah. Yeah, it's EastEnders special. EastEnders versus the Terminator, which would be, I'd watch that actually, if he came and slaughtered all of them in Albert Square. No, this is a Terminator special, marking the release of Terminator Genisys, if you technically want to pronounce it.
Genisys.
In its stupid title.
It's that thing that guys do with other guys in the shower.
Well, I wouldn't know much about that, but obviously you're quite an expert. With me tonight, I am, of course, Tony Black of Black Hole Cinema. And with me tonight is my esteemed guest, Mr. Lee Crimes. Hello.
Hello. Very That's nice. all the intro you're getting. I didn't have anything like pre-prepared or witty to say, so hello.
Well, let's.
How are you?
Yes, we're going to be, aside from making really bad jokes and being very camp, we're going to be discussing the Terminator films tonight, obviously, in honour of Terminator Genisys. And we're going to go through the entire catalogue. So we're talking The Terminator, Terminator 2, Judgment Day, Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines. This isn't very good, Arnie, is it? But
I'm Terminator 4, Salvation.
Salvation.
The one that we do not talk about.
No, what's that? Where was that going? Where was that accent going?
I don't know. That was even worse than mine.
I was doing a really good one earlier when I was just talking about explaining the film to my girlfriend after I'd seen it and doing my Sarah Connor. But it was coming out really nicely. And then that just went a bit Caribbean just
that
then.
Was
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I was going the same way. It's fine. Yeah, and then of course we're gonna do the box office as well. I'm going to do my latest director's corner, and we'll talk a bit about who we're dealing with later. And then we're going to finish with Terminator Genisys. So the best place to start is to go right back to the beginning, to go back to 1984, to where this all started with James Cameron's The Terminator.
In this city, under cover of darkness, someone is stalking Sarah Connor.
Sarah Connor?
Yes.
Sarah Connor, 35, brutally shot to death in her home.
You're dead, honey.
What's this? Dead girl, too.
Sarah Louise Connor. Is this right?
Of course, we'll have more on this late-breaking story as it comes in.
She doesn't know why, but it's her he's after.
Did you reach next girl yet?
No, I keep getting an answer machine.
Pick up if you're there. I'm really scared. I
think that there's somebody after me.
And no one can help her, except for one man.
Is that the 80s stylings of Sarah Connor's music?
It might be. I've seen so many things these days that recreate the visual and tonal aesthetic of that particular bit of the mid-80s, when it's all kind of, you know, neon lettering and swishy cars and sort of sports cars in sort of smoky alleyways and that kind of thing. Obviously, a lot of people culturally owe a big debt to that particular era at the moment.
Well, that's very true. We seem to be in a retro phase, because The Terminator itself is arguably one of the seminal 1980s movies, given it began a franchise that obviously is still running. It's set in 1984, filmed in 1984, and it was the first film that really put James Cameron on the map as a major directorial talent, and in many ways Arnold Schwarzenegger as, you know, Arnie in his signature role of a cyborg assassin who's sent back in time from the year 2029 from a post-apocalyptic wasteland in which a evil computer program called Skynet has basically destroyed the entire human race, or most of the human race, and the world is now a dark future wasteland ruled by machines. And there is, of course, one way this can all change, because in the future there is a resistance movement led by a man called John Connor, who is effectively like a Jesus Christ figure, who forms a resistance to fight the machines. And so, knowing they're about to lose, Skynet sends back a cyborg assassin in human form to the year 1984 to kill John Connor's mother, so creating a temporal paradox in time in which the man who saves the human race in the future, or is about to save the human race in the future, will never be born. And this, of course, is the template of the first movie, in which we don't know anything about the future world, because obviously in later films, Skynet and the future 2029 is much more explored, and in, you know, the associated TV series. But right at the beginning, we don't know anything about it, and it's fair to say that it's a very lo-fi kind of, very different kind of film to the rest, isn't it, Lee?
It's massively low budget, which is the main thing. It's a very visually cyberpunky kind of film. It's all sort of suspicious torch beams sweeping across the urban LA, sort of downtown LA wasteland area, which is why it was such a visually iconic thing that carried on into the second movie. There's lots of parallels between the wasteland that Kyle's running around in at the start, being hunted by searchlights and machines, to when he's directly just jumped back to 1984 and being hunted through some shopping malls and down some grimy alleyways by some cops. It's all very deliberately shot on stage to make it seem like he's gone from just one battleground to another one, with the only difference being that the people coming after him are actual people rather than sort of 20-foot tall chrome-plated tanks with lasers, which is, you know, does improve his odds slightly once he's sort of stolen the pants off the naked... he's stolen the pants off the homeless guy out in the middle of the street. And then the cool Russian army soldier t-shirt thing that he wears for most of the film. How they try to play a lot of the film, you know, the nightclub that Sarah goes to hide in, the way that the punks look at the start, that Arnie first encounters, the whole thing's very much tied to the era that it happens in. And that's one of the things that, like all good horror, makes it so relatable to a lot of audiences, because even though it's involving two people from the future, it's something that's happening now and could be happening in the here and now.
Well, I think that's what's interesting. You describe it as horror there. And I think there's a good case for that, because it's quite a brutal, quite nihilistic film, the first Terminator, as is the second one, but in a different sense. And it really does feel quite horrific in many places. It's, even though it's ostensibly a thriller, it's oddly enough, I don't know if you think this, but it's oddly enough not particularly science fiction in many ways, is it really? Because even though obviously you've got this future sci-fi element, it feels very much just like a very stark, lo-fi, quite terrifying, horrific chase thriller, doesn't it?
It's a slasher movie, is the best thing. Sarah Connor is like an archetypal final girl in many ways, even in the small cast that we've got. Apart from the scenes at the beginning, or Kyle's very brief flashbacks to the war zone of the future, and then towards the end when Arnie's Terminator starts to get some battle damage, but then definitely after the tanker explosion when the actual endoskeleton's chunking around, is when it starts to become a bit more overtly sci-fi. But even at that point, the endoskeleton's just a big relentless killer, just... who can't stop until he's killed them, just coming after them with only a single purpose in mind. That kind of thing is the very essence. That hasn't changed from, you know, Jason Voorhees or Freddy Krueger or any other thing that you might care to mention. That's why I think the first Terminator in particular is much more overtly a horror movie than it is anything else.
I think that's very true. And I think one of the reasons that I don't think it's the best Terminator film, but I think it's very, very close to T2 in terms of being brilliant. I think it's still a fantastic movie. I think it's one of the best movies of the 80s. Every time I watch it, I just feel it's got the most pure... It's the most pure form of this very idea, really. I mean, obviously, as with everything, sequels always expand on things, and the whole mythology and world of Terminator has grown. But I think when you boil it down, it is really... The first film is what it is about. The whole thing it is about this predestination paradox. It is about this, you know, this relentlessness. And this was the film that, of course, coined a lot of the well known lines. Not just Arnie, you know, with his very sparse dialogue, like "I'll be back" and things like that. Although, was it T1 where he says "I'll be back," or was that T2?
Yeah, it's T1 just before he comes back and starts shooting at the police station, which is where we the audience encounter. Dr. Silverman's there for a bit, and also Lance Henriksen, who was originally, as we know, slated to be the Terminator before Cameron's encounter with Schwarzenegger made him rethink his approach to how a killing machine from the future would look. Kind of like how footage exists from Back to the Future with Eric Stoltz as Marty McFly before he fell out and they reshot it. It'd be fascinating to see. I don't think they ever got as far as shooting anything with Lance Henriksen as the Terminator. he's looked like he's 50 years old for at least the last sort of 40 years now. So it'd be quite interesting to see how him as the Terminator would have worked. You could argue that Arnie's limited acting skills helped him nail the robotic nature that was needed a bit better than someone who was perhaps more used to very nuanced acting, but, you know, we'll never know on that one.
Well, I think there's probably something to that, really. I mean, you know, you could say, not necessarily, I mean, Robert Patrick, when he was the killer in T2, he's quite a good actor, but he managed to have that robotic sense of relentlessness about him. But no, the Arnie thing, there's a big proportion of, well, that's what made Terminator so iconic straight away, you know. And it's, like I say though, it's about certain of the pop culture moments and lines that have stuck from the first film, like Kyle Reese saying, "Come with me if you want to live," to Sarah Connor. You know, it's those pure kind of lines, and that chilly moment where he says, "It doesn't have pity or fear or remorse, and it will not stop absolutely until you are dead." And that is just, there's something just terrifying in the way he says that, because it is just final. At that moment, you know that this is something that will never stop, and it is, that's just brilliant. I think.
Yeah, it's the classic things that carry over into a lot of supernatural slasher movies, where you've Halloween style, you've got this relentless thing that's only, all it wants to do is kill you, and it doesn't care how it does it or when it does it, but at some point it's going to. It's been tapped into with that indie horror movie It Follows, which everyone is raving about at the moment, that runs across a similar idea, that there's something coming after you, and sooner or later it's going to catch up with you and kill you, and all you are doing is just delaying the inevitable in that case.
Yeah.
The whole of the Terminator movie's dark anyway. It's sort of shot mostly at night. It's all the scenes are kind of flooded. They're the light's taken out of a lot of them, so that in a way that's to sort of hide the lack of practical effects or the locations that were being used. But in the music, which is often very kind of weird atonal keyboard stabby noises,
Brad Fiedel's score for this is amazing. I love the score for this.
It's very atypical. It's very kind of Planet of the Apes, really. And yeah, so the whole thing is built around this idea of creating this oppressive atmosphere where it's just these two people completely outmatched on the run from this thing that we learn gradually, very carefully learn more about as the film progresses. But, you know, where a lot of slasher movies, especially in their sequels, go wrong is that they start to tell you too much about the protagonist and the silent killer, and it takes a lot of the mystique about them. In this one, you already know from the start going in what this is. It's a robot with human skin that's just coming after them, and it's the lack of empathy that makes it so terrifying.
But you don't know much. That's what I liked as well, in that you don't you see, like, you know, 2029 when it's all gone, when the machines have won, but you don't really know much about beyond that. You don't know, compared to the level of we know now with the mythology and everything, I quite like the fact that, you know, a lot, we don't know who John Connor is at that point. We don't know the name John Connor, let's face it. You know, she hasn't actually named him yet. It's just her son-to-be. And it's that whole thing of, you know, I quite like that there is still an element of mystery about the whole thing, and an element of, you know, how this all happens. And obviously T2, it deals with that brilliantly, as we'll get onto later. You know, it really changes what the whole texture of the saga is, but I quite like the mystery.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, by leaving a chunk of it up to your imagination, it works really nicely. In the fact that Michael Biehn, how do you pronounce his surname? I've often wondered that. Is it Biehn? Biehn?
No, I think it's Biehn. I think it is Biehn.
I always thought it was Biehn.
He's Mr. Biehn, otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. He's not the best actor, bless him, but he's sort of scrawny and desperate looking enough in this to sort of convey a guy who's just seen the end of the world and has struggled to come to terms with it after that. But also in the neat little segues. I think there's one sequence where Kyle falls asleep in a car that he's just stolen. I think it's before he's met Sarah. And he has a flashback to going on the run with, I think he's in a war zone in the future with this other resistance fighter, and she gets zapped by a hunter killer before he goes running off to the base. And he wakes up and there's a big rototiller or some kind of construction thing moving past him in the background that's woking him up. And it's a visual motif that Battlestar Galactica eventually played into, especially in its finale, by kind of saying, well, yeah, this is where we are now, and if you think about it, these horrible, nightmarish, massive killing machines in the future aren't too far, there aren't too many steps along from this, in the same way that you look at any child who grew up in the 80s looks at a car and imagines what kind of transform it might turn into. It's a similar thing with this. It's like, well, you don't really know all the steps in between, but you get enough information that if you've got the right kind of imagination, you will just fill in all the gaps and build the mythology up for yourself. And I dare say a lot of the discussion and talk around that is what led to it expanding and developing in certain ways over the subsequent films.
Speaking of Kyle Reese, obviously he was the resistance fighter sent back to save Sarah. Michael Biehn was chosen, obviously, but originally Sting was considered for the role.
Yeah, I don't think James Cameron really had the best pick of actors when he was initially going. He definitely got lucky in his early films, I think. But there's a lot of questionable casting choices in his early films. Like, I think James Remar was down to play Hicks in Aliens originally, which would have been a completely different film. Yeah, so there's a lot of switches back and forth. But in this one, it's the fact that, you know, Linda Hamilton, Michael Biehn and Schwarzenegger just nail those roles really nicely.
Yeah. That Rosanna Arquette was also auditioned for Sarah as well.
Yeah, and, you know, arguably she possibly wouldn't have done too bad with that. But Sting's one of those guys who just knows the right people and gets himself in connections, but then he's just, no. Well, this was not ever.
Well, this was coming off the back of Dune, probably. Because Dune was the year before. And
how is that an advertisement to anybody for an acting career? I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know, exactly. And this was probably the period where he's done with the police for a while and he wants to go off and play. But yeah, it's the other big casting thing with this, obviously, was O.J. Simpson was seriously in the running for Terminator.
Yes, again.
Which
do you know why? It's because all these people would have been cheap compared to getting an actual established actor in to do it. Because James Cameron didn't have no money to make this film. Arnie didn't need to get paid a lot for this first movie because he was, I think, by investing in California real estate when he first moved to the States, he was a millionaire by the time he was 22. So he was all right for money. So consequently, he was able to save, be like a good imposing presence who was already starting to get a name for himself, but did not cost Cameron a lot of money to cast him as a result.
Well, there's two great things about this. The one is that the studio had suggested O.J. Simpson as for the role of the Terminator, but Cameron didn't feel that he'd be believable as a killer, which is hilarious when you look at it.
Honk,
honk. Yeah. And the other thing, there's a quote by James Cameron on casting Schwarzenegger, which is, he says this, he says, "Casting Schwarzenegger as our Terminator, on the other hand, shouldn't have worked. The guy is supposed to be an infiltration unit, and there's no way you wouldn't spot a Terminator in a crowd instantly if they look like Arnold. It made no sense whatsoever. But the beauty of movies is that they don't have to be logical. They just have to have plausibility. If there's a visceral cinematic thing happening that the audience likes, they don't care if it goes against what's likely." There's a lot of truth in that, I think.
There is a lot of truth in that. And it plays to a great sense of actual internal logic as well. Because to us as people, if we were designing an infiltration unit, we probably would have gone with Lance Henriksen or some everyman-looking dude who you wouldn't look twice at. It's like that line from the first Matrix movie that Mouse comes out with. How did the machines know what chicken tastes like? How does the machine know what a perfect infiltration unit looks like? It knows what a good soldier looks like, which is like a massive, you know, 7-foot-tall chrome-plated killing machine. And it thinks, all right, well, we've got to put some skin over this. Oh, it's come out looking like this after we've spray-tanned it. Oh, that'll do. Humans won't really notice. They all look the same to us anyway. Ship me the time machine, off he goes. So in a way, that's been used in the other films a few times, that the machine's understanding of logic and how they approach these things is one of their biggest weaknesses, because they don't think like humans do, and they never will, as smart as they are. That's what ultimately leads to us being able to defeat them. Did you know? You do know about the deleted cut scenes right at the end of the Terminator that were kind of brought back in Terminator 2. There's a shot of just it's after the film's ended and Sarah's kind of being tended to in the ambulance outside the factory where she's been fighting the Terminator, that then fades into the bit on the desert and there's a storm coming bit.
Yeah.
As she's being wheeled out of the factory, a sign pans up. The camera sort of pans up and reveals the sign Cyberdyne Systems in big letters over the factory, and there's another shot a second later of a guy finding like a bit of the chip and arm left from the squashed Terminator, kind of looking at them in a puzzled sort of way, that obviously was used and set up again in Terminator 2 and is a recurring thing that happens a lot in the comic books as well to keep the continuity going, which suggests, as we'll get to in the other films, this whole sense of the inevitability of events and the causal loop of, you know, Kyle has to go back in time to Father John so that he can get sent back in time you know, paradox of the whole thing. So Cameron apparently cut those scenes because the quality of them wasn't quite enough, and he felt that, like you said, the film ends quite ambiguously anyway, but it's just interesting to know that it was going to be a lot more overtly to kind of say, oh no, we've accidentally just ensured that it all happens anyway.
Right, exactly, which is a big point that happens in the later films, obviously, with about the old idea that maybe, you know, this temporal loop is what causes Skynet in the first place. But
it's a fixed point in time.
It's a fixed point in time. Obviously, it took 7 years then for a lot of back behind the scenes things to be worked out, and for Cameron to actually make Terminator 2 after on the back of some big, you know, one big success and one, you know, middling, difficult one. But then he went on to make Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Same make.
These were taken at the West Highland Police Station, 1984. You were there.
Same model.
These were taken today.
You have to let me see my son. He's in great danger.
New mission. Once, he was programmed to destroy the future.
You don't know what it's like to try to kill one of these things.
Now, his mission...
Get down!
...is to protect it.
Mom!
Come with me if you want to live.
Terminator 2 is arguably, and I'll punch anyone in the face over this, one of the greatest sequels of all time. It's... Yeah. People who throw Godfather Part 2 out there are just, yeah, whatever. It's Empire Strikes Back and Terminator 2. Everybody knows this. The reason that Terminator 2 works is because it follows the best rules of a sequel to anything, which is you take what worked in the original and you turn it up a notch. And in this case, we get exactly that. We still get a robot from the future has been sent back in time to kill an important person. And you add that by throwing in your additional robot, the reprogrammed T-800. You've got an additional person to save now that you've got John and Sarah Connor. You've got the increased threat of the robot coming back in the upgraded T-1000. And the whole thing, the set pieces in it from start to finish, the level of threat that's involved, the fact that they up their scale to try and take the fight back to Cyberdyne and Skynet, killing it before it's even born. Turns everything way past 11, even Cameron's now famous use of the orange and blue lighting effect that's just so prevalent throughout the entire film. I'm amazed it took me so many years to notice it. But in every sort of way, in terms of the humour, the scale of the set pieces, the expansion of the mythology, even the glimpses that we then see of the future to paint the missing puzzle pieces that we didn't have before, Terminator 2 vastly improves on the original and also just makes for a massively influential and entertaining film in terms of, you know, pushing the boundaries in special effects as much as anything else, so that you couldn't trip over something without hearing the phrase morphing being used as a example of special effects, and how it came to just define action movies of the 90s coming out when it did in its scale and presence, to the point that, again, it's still like a benchmark for how to just do a kick-ass sequel and improve on everything in every way later.
Yeah, and I think you'd be hard-pushed to find anyone who disagreed with that, really. I think Terminator 2 is a very different kind of film, really, than the first one, even though it's, you know, it's got the same essential... It's got a very similar premise, obviously, in the fact that, again, Terminators are coming back in time to stop one who now is John Connor, having been born, and he's now a young man and a teenage tearaway who is struggling with the idea of his destiny, given he's, you know, Sarah Connor's obviously locked up in an asylum, so everyone thinks she's crazy because she's had to go militant in order to try and stop Skynet. And then you've got John Connor, who's basically running away from his destiny, and he's rebelling against it. And then, but arguably, I think, and a lot of people have said this, the genius point, in fact, Mark Kermode said this recently when he was reviewing Genesis, the genius point about Terminator 2 is the fact that it flips Arnie, and Arnie now becomes the hero Terminator as opposed to the villain. I mean, that is just a stroke of fucking genius. It really is.
It's one of the things that works so well, because by that point Arnie's been in a bunch more films, gotten a lot better at acting, and is able to handle the subtlety of this very different character that he's playing. He's still got the essential robotic nature of being a machine down pat, arguably better than he does in the later films when he's trying a bit too hard to convincingly portray a machine. But there's so many little recurring motifs, like how in in the first movie, the first time that Sarah encounters Reese at that nightclub just before the Terminator attacks them both, she isn't sure whether which one of them's there to kill her at first. And I think the idea was that initially Cameron wanted to try and make it more ambiguous as to whether it was Reese or Arnie that had actually come back to kill her for the audience. But then obviously, you know, the marketing was built so heavily around Arnie, then you kind of knew that it was going to be him. In this one, again, we, the audience, knew going in that Arnie was the hero, but that first time that John sees Arnie sort of taking the shotgun out of the, yeah, the box of roses and storming towards him, much as it's later seen again when Sarah sees Arnie emerging from the elevator in the asylum just as she's trying to escape, it's that moment of you can see the characters going, oh god, it's happening again, or this thing is coming here to kill me. And even though it's only like a little moment, it means that we take the flip with them of to kind of realizing, oh, this thing that previously an identical version of this thing tried to kill me, and now it's come back with slightly spikier hair and it wants to be on my side. So okay, where are we with that? It gives everyone in the film a lot more agency, for one thing. The fact that Sarah's doing her damned best to break out of the mental asylum from the very first scene that we meet her says as much as anything else. John's no slouch either, you know, he's capable enough for now this is the bit that always throws me. We're trying to work out John's age, because he's given as being 12, I think, which actually it's either like 11 or 12 he's cast as, which actually sets Terminator 2 in about 1994-95.
Well, it makes sense if he's about 13, because if I'm right, and this is something that they touch on in Genesis, 1997 was supposed to be the year of Judgment Day, wasn't it? And that's basically what I've always taken it, that it's set in 1997, so he's about 13, 12 or 13, yeah, because if she would have given birth in 1985, technically, so this is presumably set in 1997. Although Wikipedia, I have just checked, Wikipedia says 95 and that he's 10 years old. So
it's a bit of a stretch. I think he's meant to be like a very mature 10 years old because of the life he's lived to that point. But it's still just it's a little wiggle, but, you know, it's one of those things that, as the films do infuriatingly do sometimes, it's never really obliquely referenced in the film. You just kind of left to work it out for yourself, depending on how obsessive you become with the film. Like I was watching it pretty much on a daily basis for several years when I was younger.
But I think that's the point, though, in that that's the reaction it gave you. You know, it became an obsession for you. I mean, I watched it a lot when I was young as well, and this was the film that really made me fall in love with the franchise, I think, even more than the first Terminator. But it's like, the mark of a really, truly great film is when it does have you looking into it all and trying to look beyond it and figure things out and reevaluate it. And I think Terminator 2 has that, because it's just got much more of that sort of, well, it's more epic for a start, you know, not just in the scale of it, but also, you know, the set pieces it does. You know, such as the freeway chase, which is just still one of the best action sequences that's ever been filmed, in my opinion.
The chase with the helicopter and the tanker, and then previously to that, the one with down the storm drain, using LA landmarks as part of the, you know, visual language of the film. That's just a brilliantly just crazy chaotic sequence from start to finish, but it totally works, and it's what sells to you completely and truly. Right, the T-1000 is a much bigger threat than we thought. It's not just another Arnie who's come back. This is a thing that could potentially take out the T-800 and kill John and Sarah without even blinking if we give it a chance to.
Well, this is the thing, you know, it's not just, apart from the fact it's got that slightly philosophical sweep of, you know, questioning the morality and questioning the, you know, the essential idea of Judgment Day and everything like that, and making it much more of a, there's much more, there are visions in there in terms of Sarah seeing the end, and, you know, there's a lot more of that. But also,
oh, I used to hate that bit.
Yeah, it's horrible, isn't it? But also the fact of the T-1000 and the effects. I mean, let's remember that, you know, it was this and Jurassic Park really that created modern cinematic effects in many respects, wasn't it? Because it was Jurassic Park had the dinosaurs a couple of years later, but it was this one with the morphing, with the liquid form that's just inspired. Well, it created ILM. It was just the beginning, wasn't it? Really, this was the film that made everyone go, "Wow!"
I think it was the first time we'd really seen what computers could really do in film.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go back to arguably one of the first proper kind of summer tentpole blockbusters of the modern era, which was Tim Burton's first Batman movie in '89, there's a lot of what would be now CG moments in that are either done with the practical effects and scale models or actually animation. There's a couple of little shots that are actually animated and put directly into the film, sort of just, you know, the pen and paper way of doing things. Terminator 2 is the point at which they say, right, if you want to do something this bonkers, do as much of it as you can in practical, and for the only for the things that you can't do any other way, use CG. But if you're going to do it, make sure it's for something that you can't do as a practical effect. And that's one of the things that so many modern movies get wrong, is that they rely on CG to do things that you can do with practical effects. Even the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park are a mix of the two, and that's why they feel so real. The moments when you know you're looking at a fully CG dinosaur, the moments in which the film feels slightly less real, when it is actually just a gigantic T-Rex head pressing down on the top of a car and trying to eat people, you feel like that thing is going to actually eat you if it gets past the windshield and gets into the car.
This is it. I think this is why a lot of people responded enormously well to Mad Max Fury Road this year, because that's exactly the same. It's old school practical effects in the grit, in the mud, mixed with CGI, and it just feels different. It feels more visceral, it feels more real, and that's exactly what T2 did, you know, and you could feel it all the way. And even though, you know, Robert Patrick and the T-1000 was this liquid moving shape, it was that kind of thing. It was still terrifying, and it was still, it just worked, and it just blew you away. And it's one of those moments, like the dinosaurs, then later, like Bullet Time with The Matrix, that made you go, Jesus Christ. You know, it's these really iconic seminal moments in the development of the technology that now we take for granted, really. So it's one of those films, I think, T2, that not just for the fact it's a great action movie and a great science fiction movie, it will go down in history as really important because of the steps that James Cameron has taken, you know, with the effects and everything like that.
Yeah, and as much as people can argue against, you know, I suppose non-highbrow movies as being important or relevant, I think movies, when you talk about movies that are influential and that have to exist in order for other films to be inspired by them and take the lead from them and go on from there, Terminator 2 is 100% up there.
So yeah, Terminator 2 was, you know, a really important influential film, and it's for me, it's the apex of the film so far, really. But we're going to take a quick break from Terminator now, and we're going to get back into the present day, just to talk about the UK box office figures, which is a recurring thing. We're not having news, obviously, this week. We've skipped on news because, you know, we've got a lot to talk about with Dominator. But I thought we'd dabble into the box office. So just go through the top 10, and it'll be interesting to see if there's any of these that you've seen, Lee. I think there's one or two.
I tell you what, I'm very behind at the moment. I'm appalled that I didn't get around to seeing Mad Max, because everyone was raving about it, and I know I'm going to love it when I see it, but it just came out at a time when I was massively busy and I just couldn't get to the cinema to see it.
Well,
but it'll be out in some form before the end of the year for me to get, so I'll just pick it up on Blu-ray as soon as I can, or
you
something.
You are definitely in for a treat, which is which is great. The current top 10 as it stands, at number 10 is Slow West, the Michael Fassbender Western, which has actually been out for 6 weeks, which I didn't realise it's been out that long, and has made 140,000 to date, which is very little, so I think that's kind of disappeared. You haven't heard of this, I think, Lee, have you?
Not in the slightest, but, it, you know, I don't hear of a lot of remotely arty films these days, or I do in passing and just think, I won't like that, and move on.
Well, there. Yeah,
my film tastes have never been particularly intellectual, you could say.
Well, it seems like most people have seemed to have moved on. Well, in fairness, it has only released in 69 cinemas, which is a little bit less. But anyway, at number 9 is San Andreas, The Rock versus Nature, which has made, in 3 weeks, 11 million, which isn't too bad. It's not like a stomping great hit, but it's done pretty well.
For a film that looked pretty bad, then that's not too bad going, I guess.
I think it was a bit ropey, but, you know, people enjoyed it. It's The Rock, anyway. People will enjoy The Rock. At number 8 is The Longest Ride, which is in its third week has made nearly a million. It's a romantic drama, a Nicholas Sparks novel, so you know what you're getting with that stuff.
Is that the one that I keep seeing with the trailers where it's the guy who's like the rodeo rider or something? Oh, yeah, that looks shit.
Clint Eastwood's son, Scott Eastwood, it turns out, and Britt Robertson from Tomorrowland. But who's a good actress, actually, and deserves to do quite well, but she seems to be picking some duff things lately. At number 7 is, in its first week at the box office, is Knock Knock, which was reviewed last week by Chris Byrne, which is the new Keanu Reeves schlock horror thriller from Eli Roth, which has made 250,000 in its first week, so expect that to drop out the top 10. I don't think people particularly care about Eli Roth or Keanu Reeves anymore, so...
I completely missed John Wick, and apparently that was quite good. I never heard about it.
I didn't see John Wick yet either, actually, and I heard it was pretty decent, but I don't think it did massively well either. So, although it did well, I think it did better in America because it's getting a sequel. But it didn't make the impact of Taken, for instance. I don't think Keanu Reeves is going to quite come back as a Liam Neeson action guy in quite the same way. Number six is Entourage, which is in its fourth week at number six. With 1.2 million, it's made. Now, to be fair, that's not much at all. You know, I mean, considering Entourage is, it used to be a TV show, I think it's a combination of things this is. I don't know if you saw the Mark Kermode rant about this, but it went quite viral. It got more views, actually, than most of his reviews do, because he basically called it worse than Sex and the City 2. And
that's pretty bad, because Sex and the City 1 was pretty diabolical.
Well, anyone who follows Kermode knows that Sex and the City 2 is basically his idea of hell on earth. So, I mean, to say this is more morally reprehensible and horrid than that film is going some. So
I've never really bothered to watch Entourage. It looks like the kind of show that thinks it's a lot cleverer and smarter and funnier than it actually is, but he's actually just a program about five dickheads.
Yeah, I suspect that, yeah, that's pretty true. At number five is The Empire Strikes Back, which, of course, is thanks to The Secret Cinema, which you and I had the privilege of going to see. We can't really talk about it, because The Secret Cinema, anyway, because we did sign confidentiality agreements. But it was awesome, and The Empire Strikes Back is awesome, as we've earlier said in this podcast. So, at number four is Mr. Holmes, which is the Ian McKellen as Sherlock Holmes film, and it's... first week of release, which has made 1.6 million, nearly 1.7 million. So that's not bad, really, considering it's a very quiet, you know, middle class film. So actually a very lovely film as well. I do recommend that.
I know, I wanted to see it. I haven't got around to it yet, and I have a feeling it's going to disappear before I get a chance to, but it did look like a lot of fun.
Possibly. It is. It's very nice. And he's fantastic as Sherlock. It's lovely. And number three is Spy, which is still hanging on in there in its third week, which has made 8.6 million. Spy actually hasn't done as well as I thought it would. It's still been hovering around the top, but all the money in the last few weeks has been eaten up by Jurassic World, as we'll see in a minute. So,
is that because it's completely awful? Because it certainly looked like it was completely awful.
Well, not at all, and that's the surprising thing. Spy's actually much, much better than I thought it would be. It was a lot of fun, mainly because Jason Statham is brilliant at sending himself up throughout that film. It's actually really quite good, yeah. So it's a bit of a shame that it hasn't really done... It's done well, but it hasn't done amazingly well. But it'll have done well for a sequel, so... And number two, Unseated, surprisingly, although I'm not surprised by what's Unseated it, but it is Jurassic World, which is made in what is about 3 weeks. It says 1 week on here, but that's not quite the case. It's made nearly 50 million in England. I mean, that is just ridiculous. That Avengers didn't make 50 million in 3 weeks. You know, it's remarkable.
The problem is, It's a very similar problem to the fact that you can't compare the points that Formula One drivers accrue now to how the drivers used to do it, because now you get 25 points for a win, where you used to get 9 or 10. Mm. You can't really sort of say, oh, this film's smashing all these records and doing this. Yeah, it's because going to the cinema can cost you up to £15 a ticket these days, which it didn't, like, you know, as recently as 10 years ago. Mm. So the amount of money that these films are making is... All it is the fact that cinema prices have gone up and the marketing spends on these things have reached titanic levels.
Yeah.
That's the only way for films to be considered a success. It's the same in every kind of form of media at the moment. Music, video games, all these other sorts of things. They consider these things failures if they don't hit these massive arbitrary targets. But the only way they're able to do that is by inflating the price point for them, which then we, the punters, have to shell out to watch or become pirates.
Well, it's why, as well, I now make a concerted effort that... Well, I hate 3D anyway. I really like IMAX, but unfortunately, you've got to really go far and wide now to find an IMAX that is just IMAX and not IMAX 3D, because they've realised that no one was going to see 3D, so they've badged IMAX and 3D together, so people will have to go and if they want IMAX, they've got to go and see 3D. So it's incredibly annoying, and it means that now I don't see IMAX for most films, because there's no IMAX, sole IMAX in the West Midlands. Well, I now make the point that I would have gone and seen Jurassic World in IMAX, but I would have gone and seen Terminator Genesis in IMAX, but I didn't. I went to see it in 2D because I refused to pay through the nose, and I refused to have to watch IMAX with 3D when I think 3D is fucking awful. So, you know.
I suffer with it because I wear glasses, and I maintain that I do not get the correct 3D visual experience because of that. I don't see a massive amount of difference in a lot of the things I watch, other than getting a slight motion headache. The only thing I found 3D really works well in is animated movies, because the massive amounts of colour that those produce compared to movies shot in the real world helps create the depth of field that 3D is trying to trick your eyes into seeing. The point is that it's all unfair.
Speaking of animated films, though, the one that knocked Jurassic World off the top spot was Minions, which is made in 1 week, actually, 12 million. So that was always going to happen, though, because Minions is basically a big cash cow. As Emma described last week when it was reviewed, it's the general response to it has been very, very lukewarm, in that it's basically just, you know, all the good bits are in the trailer, and it's a joke, that a 10-15 minute joke that's been stretched out into a movie. And it's basically a marketing cash cow machine, which is true, because you look anywhere. I mean, I was walking past I was in a supermarket at Sainsbury's, I think it was, earlier today, and I just looked to the right, and there's about 4 Minions T-shirts for adults. You know, so it's just a machine.
The thing about films like that is, and it's a problem that a lot of us who watch films based on superheroes or like Transformers or other sorts of franchises that were around when we were kids, is that these films, they're not for us, they're made for children.
Yeah.
And there'll be kids going to see Minions, and 30 years from now they'll be saying it was one of their favourite films when they were a kid, and they will defend it until their dying breath. Us as adults, we go and see it, we can tell that it's just been a thinly put together film that's just a bit of a, you know, like you said, a marketing cash cow, basically working on the popularity of them as characters. But then it's not really meant to, you know, connect with us beyond like a few jokes for the mums and dads that they always sneak into these movies. So in a way, you kind of, it's a very hard thing to do, and it's the thing that only the best kind of, you know, media critics ever really, or cultural critics ever really get right, which is being able to look at something outside of their own objectivity. And Minions is a classic example of that, because, you know, all the grown-ups are going to see it, or can I say, nah, it's a load of rubbish, that I didn't like it, and then all the kids who went to see it will just be, like I said, raving about that for years to come, about how brilliant it was, and that's what the film's set out to do, and it's done it. So
yeah,
can't argue with that.
Well, there you go. I think next week it will be more than likely Terminator Genesis will be high up. I'm not sure it will necessarily beat Jurassic World, but I think it will be up there. So as will Magic Mike Triple X, or whatever it's called, XXL. But I will say, actually, very quickly, we won't review it on the podcast, unfortunately, because of the way this has worked, but I went to see Amy yesterday, the Amy Winehouse documentary, Asif Kapadia, who made Senna, and it is a stunning piece of work. I recommend it, because the story of Amy Winehouse isn't quite what you think it is, and it is desperately, desperately sad. And I now have a hell of a lot more respect for her as a musician and her life, because it is a really, really tragic tale. And it's just a brilliantly put together documentary. So I really encourage anyone who likes music to go and watch that. Let's move back to the meat of the podcast, to get back to Terminator. And we are now moving on to Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines.
The life you know, all the stuff you take for granted, it's not gonna last. Imagine a world of permanent darkness, where machines control man's destiny. Imagine you were the only one who could stop it. But before you do, something terrible has to happen.
monitoring systems have been infected.
This can't be happening.
John Connor was here. Where is he?
Are you going to kill me?
No. My mission is to protect you.
This is the point that I think most people agree that Terminator starts to lose its oomph. Now, obviously, Terminator 3 was filmed, was a good 13 years later, and crucially, this is the point that James Cameron effectively parts ways. He was a bit still involved in this one, but it wasn't to the same degree. He didn't write it, he didn't direct it. This was by Jonathan Mostow, who came on board, who had previously done Breakdown with Kurt Russell, which was a great little film, like a modern-day Duel, which was very good. So, you know, he's not a bad director at all. But the third film was, it was just before Arnie went off and did, you know, 10 years destroying California in office.
The Governator.
And it was in many ways his last, you know, I think he thought maybe that he was going to be giving up acting. So it was kind of his last hurrah, one of his last hurrahs, really. And it was possibly a slightly misjudged film in that, you know, one of the big things it does is it kills off Sarah Connor, which is something that I think was very questionable to a lot of people, in that, you know, she's such a crucial character to the whole thing. And, you know, there was an element of logic in that, you know, you make it about John Connor and you pair him with a female, you know, character, and have him again being hunted as a man. I understand that idea, but without Sarah Connor, this has just lost something. And it's one of those films that I actually think it's a lot better than people give it credit for, Rise of the Machines.
It really is. It really is. A lot of people just dissed it on principle, and it gets a very unfairly bad reception, I think.
It really does. It is not in the same league as the first two. You know, that's obvious. It does have some really wobbly ideas, like, you know, Kristanna Loken as the TX with her inflatable boobs and things like that. He's really quite like.
I think that's their attempt at that slightly awkward humour that they put in all the Terminator movies, really. Like all the cheesy things they make Arnie say in the second one, or the ongoing gag with him trying to smile in Genesis. I think that's purposefully tongue in cheek, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah. But I think one of the things that they've never quite done as well as James Cameron is managed to make the two blend together in quite as effective a way. I mean, the first film doesn't have much of it at all. The first film is a lot more serious and dark and weird and grungy. The second film definitely has those character moments, like, you know, with John Connor trying to ingratiate the Terminator into modern, you know, cool speak, you know, and all that kind of thing, and those comic moments. But it just seems to work better. We're in this. It's not bad, and there are some really funny moments, like Talk to the Hand, which I always find funny, and I often do myself, Talk to the Hand. You know, there are some good bits, but it does feel like it's being forced a little bit more. So, you know, I think there are some questionable ideas. You know, Nick Stahl isn't necessarily the best, you know, John Connor you would have ever had.
No, I think he was a bit miscast in it. He's my main kind of problem with the film, really. I think Claire Danes is brilliant as Kate, I think. Because she's got the right blend of kind of slightly disbelieving, wide-eyed annoyance at everything that's happening to her throughout the whole thing. I think Kristanna Loken does a pretty all right job as the Terminatrix, or whatever they end up calling her, to be honest.
Yeah,
but yeah, Nick Stahl just doesn't... Edward Furlong had that edginess about him, in the sense of someone who could go on... He was just this raw mess of untapped potential, and he could go on to be someone great. Nick Stahl's kind of... It's like the big... problem that happened with that I always say happened with Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies, where they ended up going with Tobey Maguire over Jake Gyllenhaal, and you got a guy who was too much of a nerd and not enough of a hero, and it's pretty much the same thing again here. Nick Stahl just doesn't feel like he's going to grow up to be John Connor.
No, he doesn't.
He feels like he's going to grow up to be one of John Connor's radio operators, you know.
but that's exactly the point. You know, he just doesn't quite have that element to him. And I think that, I mean, Edward Furlong, they wanted him back, but then by then he'd gone a bit mad and off the rails and everything like that, a bit like John Connor when he was that age, so he didn't come back for this. But it was the whole thing with this that I think it had its problems, but I think what people forget is that there are some moments in this that are really, really well executed. I would argue that the massive big chase sequence through LA with that enormous crane that the Terminator has to hang off is one of the best.
Oh, that is so much fun.
It is wonderfully done. It's one of the best in the whole franchise. It's fucking awesome. You know, it barrels along for like 10 minutes and it's relentless and it's epic. It really, really, really good. And I will argue as well that, I mean, obviously the whole plot in the end is, again, you know, Judgment Day has been delayed through the timey-wimey ideas of this. And it's happening after 1997, obviously. But this plot involving them trying to stop Skynet in the end when, you know, when they get the chance. But what I love about this film, and what I think it was unfairly criticised for, is the balls of the ending. Because that...
Oh, absolutely. It's so brave.
Balls. It really does. Yeah, obviously, you know, spoilers, but the ending, Skynet... Judgment Day happens. After three films are building up to it, that's it. The bombs fall. The inevitability of the future goes off and Skynet wins, effectively. Well, there's no effectively about it. It does win. And you're left with this kind of, Jesus Christ.
That's what really won the film over for me, just as much as it put a lot of people off it, because it's building towards this final confrontation and John and Kate are running around the Cyberdyne labs and getting attacked by all the kind of prototype hunter-killer models while Arnie and the Terminatrix are having their sort of final scrap outside. And then it's that just moment where they get down into the bunker and then they realise, oh, no, we can't turn anything off. This is where we're supposed to hide and survive everything out. And it's that great... It's almost like back to that horror movie moment of the sudden realisation of, oh, God, they've been fucked right from the very start. There was no way... It was never going to go down any differently. That they were never going to be able to stop it. That when it all goes off... That's the point at which I was leaning back and going, that's fucking brilliant. And then a lot of other people were obviously going, oh, but they were supposed to stop it. Oh, it's not a happy ending. I automatically don't like it. I should tell all of my friends on the Twitters.
But that's the whole point. I mean, that's why I agree with you in that they forget the whole point of Terminator is that it will always happen. And that's you know, something that I think will be borne out in the future films that we may well get, but we'll get to that later. But the whole idea that, you know, Judgment Day is that, like you said earlier, that fixed point in time. This will always happen, or it will always threaten to happen. It is something that you cannot stop, and that's what T3, you know, like T2, even though T2 did end it with that idea of hope, there was also that undercurrent of, you know, well, this will probably happen one day. It's this, and this really does go with that, and I think to do that in a massive big blockbuster is brave, and I think I really, really admire it for not chickening out when it could have very easily done something a lot more, oh well, you know, we've stopped it for now, you know, and it's, which is something that Genesis later does, and it's that whole thing of, you know, good on it.
Well, again, two quick points to make. One is that when you say big, massive blockbuster film, I don't know if anyone else ever thought this, but the way Terminator 3 starts with a very kind of low-key pan across the street and the TX appearing, and just the way the credits are just popping up very kind of unobtrusively on the screen, it doesn't open with a big flashbang. It opens almost like a TV movie. It weirdly feels very kind of like subdued and downplayed when it starts. But the main point I was going to make, the recurring motif, especially in Terminator 2, around the time Sarah has a dream and then decides to pretend to be a Terminator and take the future into her own hands, is that whole there's no fate but what we make for ourselves, the future's not set thing. And again, the deleted ending to Terminator 2, which shows the old grandma Sarah Connor watching John, a grown-up John, play with his kids in a park in LA, the same one where she earlier in the film had her nuclear nightmare. Test audiences didn't like that because they thought it was too neat, which is why we had that hastily added in just shot of the rolling road and that thing of Sarah saying, oh, well, we've stopped this thing from happening, but, you know, we still don't know what else is going to come up. And it's... I think the ideas both work in tandem. One is that some things, we've got ourselves to a point where some things are always going to happen, but that ties in, there's no fate but what we make for ourselves. The fate we have made for ourselves is that we are going to create something that's going to turn on us and destroy the world. And that's the bit that we can't escape. What we do ourselves as individuals, that's the bit that we can control, and that's what we do. Our own futures aren't set, but the future of, you know, time itself, how these events are going to play out in one way or another, it's always going to come about. It's the whole, it's the Final Destination or Butterfly Effect I'm trying to think of, where no matter what you're trying to do, it's some sooner or later, what wants to happen somehow finds a way to happen.
The Terminator films are a great example of the Butterfly Effect, really. You know, in that causal effect and, you know, the inevitability of time. You know, Terminator 3, obviously, it served as kind of a... what you might call as an ending point in some respects at that point, because obviously Arnold Schwarzenegger had given up the role and he'd given up acting. You had the Skynet win, so you know you've effectively locked that off. So where do you go? And obviously, you know, they never want to completely shut down a cash cow, even though the films have been making less money since Terminator 2. But then the next move was a very different one, wasn't it? With Terminator Salvation.
We've been fighting a long time. We are outnumbered by machines. Humans have a strength that cannot be measured. This is John Connor. If you're listening to this, you are the Resistance. I thought I knew our enemy. Something has changed. Skynet is taking human prisoners. Replicating human tissue.
Let's see what we've got here.
And in this future, I don't know that we can win this war.
Terminator Salvation, again, if you can forgive the fact that McGee, or whatever he likes to call himself, was in it. Terminator Salvation, again, is a perfectly good film that gets a lot of bad stick just because it's not what people wanted a Terminator movie to be. And I don't think at this point, if you ask 10 people on the street what they would want the next Terminator film to be like, you would get 10 different answers.
That is true.
It's a perfectly competent war story and a kind of one man's moral journey thing smushed together. And from what I can tell of the troubled production history of the film, various points it was weighted more towards Sam Worthington's character, Marcus, and other times more towards Christian Bale as John Connor's side of the story. And the resulting film is very much a 50-50 blend of the two that you could argue is a little less focused, because their two stories don't properly come together until like the third act of the film, much as they spend a lot of the film together with each other. But Terminator Salvation's a war movie. We're in the future, you know, it's after Judgment Day, but not quite far enough ahead that we've got to the time-travelling bit yet. But the machines are starting to figure out what they need to do. They've got their very sort of clunky early model Terminators. They're, you know, still trying to harvest humans, but there's a lot more humanity out there. You know, we're sort of 10 years away from the completely burned-out nuclear wasteland that we see in the previous films. And while you've got Marcus going on his journey discovery through that and waking up, you know, in the future and realizing that he's been sort of half made into a cyborg, and that there's this kind of internal battle for his soul going on as to which side he's going to fall on, I don't know whether a lot of people just wanted there to be more Arnie in it. And I think the fact that he wasn't, it almost kind of feels like a spin-off film in a lot of ways. Like, it's kind of stories that are happening around the other films rather than being its own solo entry into the rest of the film. I mean, admittedly, it's a little confusing at places. It's a little all over the place. Moon Bloodgood's character, kind of, you don't really know what to do with her. Bryce Dallas Howard, who I understand was heavily pregnant through most of the film, does very little other than sit around and just, you know, look pretty for the most part. And let's be honest, a lot of people out there massively dislike Christian Bale just on principle, and I think that put a lot of people off the film, given that he spends a chunk of it barking at people. And of course, that very famously recorded flip out that he had the one day on set when that lighting assistant just pissed him off and he blew up at him, which is both equal parts kind of slightly douchey actor speak, and also if someone was doing that to me in the middle of a really intense scene, I'd probably flip out and lose my shit as well. Flip-flopping accent in that scene, in that recording, is the funniest part of it. But again, we talk about the tank, the chase through LA bit in Terminator 3 as being a standout. The opening sequence of Salvation, there's this brilliant one-shot sequence in it when they're escaping from the base, when they find the underground base with Marcus before he wakes up, and The Terminator endoskeletons that Connor remarks as they seem different to how he thinks they should be, which already starts to hint that we're on a slightly different timeline of events caused by the, you know, Judgment Day happening in 2003 in Terminator 3 rather than in 97 like it was supposed to. So he's already noticing that things aren't going how he expected them to, which is something that I think was spiritually carried over into Genesis. There's this one-shot sequence of the escape as everything's just going to shit and things are blowing up around him. He tries to get in the helicopter as it flies off, and then that gets shot down and he crashes out of it. It's one continuous shot, and it's just brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And there's a lot of moments like that, like the scene when he crashes a helicopter into the lake and the little swimmy centurion thingies are coming after him. There's loads of just awesome moments in that film. The actual assault on Skynet, you know, there's a lot more good stuff that happens in that film than people remember. All people tend to fixate on is Helena Bonham Carter's abysmal acting. I don't know what she was on that day, but she's just terrible in this. And again, you know, the fact that there's no Arnie in it apart from that kind of faux Arnie that they fight at one point, although that is a pretty awesome moment when the pretend Arnie gets sort of comes stomping out to fight them at one point. But again, does a very brave thing to try and mix up how the franchise was going forward, and has ultimately Marcus sacrificing himself, choosing humans over the machines, so that John Connor can live. And again, in original cuts of the film, and it's always important, I think, if you're getting into a franchise or, you know, learning more about a film, to find out how it could have gone, because it'll inform the choices that you see in the film. Originally, the idea was that Connor was going to die outright, and that Marcus was going to take on Connor's appearance and basically become John Connor so that he could continue the fight in his name. I think they realized there wasn't a way to really sell that to the audience, you know, through the technology available to him that would have really made sense. So it made more sense for John Connor to be dying and for Marcus to make this ultimate sacrifice and to give him his heart. And then you've got a John Connor who has to live with the fact that he has a machine's heart keeping him alive. But I think for the ideas at play in it, the action sequences that kick off, and just again the bravery of some elements of it, I think Salvation is a perfectly good film. I think it gets a lot of bad stick for no real reason, and I think you should go and sit and watch it again objectively if you haven't seen it for a while, and you might find that you actually quite enjoy it.
I think you've given that a very, very good defence there, actually. I mean, I watched it, I think, last year, because I went through the four of them last year again. And I hadn't seen it. I remember really quite enjoying it the first time around, actually. I remember going to the cinema and really liking it. In fact, I may have gone with you, possibly. I'm not sure. We may have.
No, I took my mum to go and see it, and I was... Because my mum loves the Terminator movies. She's always been a very geeky person when it comes to her film tastes, and I was just cracking up because she's one of these... She's at the age now where she likes to shout advice at the characters on the screen, especially at really quiet, tense moments when they're infiltrating bases and she's shouting at them to not open the door because that's where the Terminators are.
Right, this is it, yeah. I mean, I enjoyed it first time round, but then I watched it last year and I found quite a few problems with it, really. I mean, for me, it just dragged. For me, it was I agree about the action sequences. I think some of them were really well staged.
Oh, it slows down massively in the middle. Once they get Marcus back to the base, it does take its foot off the gas for a good half hour.
I think in terms of narrative and plotting, I think Christian Bale looks bored. You know, I think there's a lot of issues with it in terms of the actual... I mean, I didn't give a shit. I mean, that's one of the biggest things. I didn't give a shit about anything.
Yeah. Connor's a bit of a douche, really, isn't he, for most of the film? He's kind of a bit of an arrogant dickhead.
Yeah, he's a bit of a grumpy, arrogant bastard. And I'm like, well, okay. I think on a visual level, I think it's got merit, definitely. I think it looks very good. I think it portrays the future machines of one Judgment Day post-apocalypse very well. But I didn't get on with the rest of it, really. So for me, it's the low point of the franchise. But no, it isn't a bad film, you know. And there are points, and I think I think you've argued the case very well for Salvation there, really. But before we get on to talking about Genesis and the future of the Terminator franchise, let's just back up a little bit, because I'm just going to go into my director's corner. And today, it felt fitting. In the last one I did, it was for the Jurassic Park retrospective, and in that one it was Steven Spielberg because of his role in the Jurassic Park films. It obviously naturally feels fitting today to talk about James Cameron, because he's the founding father of Terminator, and the DNA of what he created is in the entire franchise.
Well, that and the many sources that he nicked the ideas from over the years, yes.
Well,
if Harlan Ellison is to be believed, anyway.
Well, yeah, exactly. But I think really, if you look at Cameron's films and biography, and we are, in many ways, he's been doing that throughout his entire career. You know, I think in terms of directors, I mean, you know, Spielberg, if Spielberg is the father of the blockbuster, I think in many ways, James Cameron is the father of modern sort of high concept cinema. Because Spielberg has done a lot more films than Cameron, and I think he's... par for par, his films are better in greater numbers, but There is no taking away from the fact that James Cameron has made some of the greatest major motion pictures of the last 30, 40 years.
James Cameron has made four of my favourite films of all time, and I don't think there's any other director who's made that many of them.
Considering as well, he hasn't really made many films, and that's when you look back at his filmography, it's surprising, really. Because obviously he got started with Roger Corman. He was like working as a miniature model maker for Roger Corman way back in the 70s. And, you know, he was like working on films like Battle Beyond the Stars, and then...
Oh, that's such a good film.
Yeah, Escape from New York. He did like special effects on Escape from New York, and was on really sort of other small random films like Galaxy of Terror and Android. And then he got in the early 80s. And so his DNA is there already, but he got his big break when he was hired as the special effects director for Piranha 2, The Spawning, where he basically ended up taking over, basically doing a lot of stuff. He was doing things for the film, and then he went to Rome, and he got struck with food poisoning. And while he was having, you know, basically his rapture in the middle of this horrible illness, he had a nightmare about an invincible robot hitman sent from the future to kill him, which gave him the idea for The Terminator, which obviously is his first major film as a director. So it's interesting how all those years working on those, you know, those very science fiction, you know, schlocky kind of B-movie pictures, and then some of these really cool early, like, 80s and late 70s kind of films gave him the foundation in order to go and do the effects work and have such an affinity to this kind of cinema, and that's obviously what spawned The Terminator.
Harlan Ellison, the famously outspoken author who has long complained about Hollywood ripping off little bits of his ideas for various movies and things, which he's not wrong in doing. I think he actually got into a lawsuit with Fox over, or was it Orion? No, it was Orion Pictures and Cameron over that opening sequence, that opening bit to The Terminator, which he felt had been lifted directly from his work. But it just goes to show with that and the work he was doing with Corman and all these other guys that Cameron was starting to soak up all these interesting ideas. But also, through working with someone as famously DIY as Roger Corman, that he'd get into the... Charles Band is the other director I think I'm thinking of as well. It's a very similar kind of lo-fi. Use practical effects as much as possible. You know, don't try to rely too much on studio trickery. And really kind of make sure you know about the things that you are doing, which is why he did so much, you know, deep sea exploration for The Abyss and Titanic, why he essentially had to create his own brand of technology to be able to capture what he was trying to do with Avatar. I think Cameron, the reason that he hasn't made a lot of films, it's like Kubrick is a perfectionist, but Cameron is one of those guys who, much like George Lucas, has to kind of invent the tech he needs to make the films he's trying to do.
I think that's very true. I think, and that's something that, you know, he's a continuing theme in his work. You know, he went on to, before he did Aliens, he actually wrote a first draft of Rambo First Blood Part 2, which Stallone nixed and then wrote his own, which was radically different, which would have been interesting to see what he would have, you know, done with Rambo, which is a fascinating thing. But he then went on to Aliens, which obviously is your favourite film.
Aliens is the greatest film of all time ever.
But yeah, Aliens, obviously, which is like Terminator 2 later on, he's in many respects arguably one of the greatest sequels ever made. And for me, it's Cameron's best film, personally. Yeah, it's interesting how, you know, in all these things, he's built on his, you know, his understanding of technology. Like you just said, you know, he went on to make The Abyss then, which is one of those films that was very difficult for him and hasn't been as well remembered by a lot of people, even though it's, you know, it's a very...
Great. The Abyss is a great film.
Very good film, but it gets a lot of stick, and it hasn't been quite loved as much as many people have said. For that, you know, it was the first time his fixation with water really came about. You know, he created immense sets with massive. I mean, he almost killed a couple of his actors, you know, at various points in the Abyss.
Oh, he always does that. I mean, it's well documented how much the British crew on Aliens hated him because he didn't like the fact that they stopped to have tea breaks.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of great cast and crew shirts which were just like loads of thinly veiled insults, or even not very thinly veiled insults at him that they would wear on set whilst working for him.
Yeah.
Michael Byrne always puts it the best, that he says, much, I think the same as Kurt Russell and John Carpenter, he's one of the guys who's been in so many James Cameron or James Cameron produced movies is because he's one of the few guys who knows how to get on with him, which is that when James Cameron gets bossy and starts shouting at people and swearing, just shout and swear back at him.
Yeah.
That's the language that he understands when he's getting passionate about something. Don't be offended and don't shrink away, just stand up to him. And a lot of people, you know, don't do that, are not willing to do that and go for it. And that happened a lot on The Abyss, as I understand it. I think Ed Harris in particular really didn't get on with him over it. But in a way, that kind of that flows out into the, you know, growing frustration and anger that's coming out of so many characters in the performances there. And, you know, sometimes, as Stanley Kubrick would probably tell you, as he would tell you, sometimes if you want to get the best performances out of your actors, you can't be nice to them. You have to be very nasty to them to get the take that works on film.
And I think, yeah, and I think the greatest directors do manage to do that, definitely. I think, obviously, then, you know, he went on to make, obviously, Terminator 2, which we've discussed, but then he had perhaps his most fun making True Lies, which is, any film, if somebody said, what film would you want to see a sequel of? I would have probably said True Lies for a long time. But in a way, I'm glad they never did, because I don't know what could have been done better, really. I don't know where you could have done, how you could have done that better a second time round.
Yeah. That's a nicely self-contained film. It works on a lot of levels. The ridiculousness of Arnie playing a secret agent as one thing. It's Last Action Hero tried to do the kind of spoofy action movie thing a few years after that and didn't work at all, because Last Action Hero is really bleak and dark for the most part. And the second half of, once they get out of the movie world and back into the real world, Last Action Hero goes really hopelessly dark and black, and I can never really get on with it. True Lies knows that you send up action movies by being even more ridiculous and over the top and overblown and nonsensical, and that's what makes them fun, and that's why it still stands up and works so well today.
Exactly, and that was the last one before he went mega, and he made the two biggest box office films, adjusted for inflation anyway, of all time, in first Titanic and then Avatar. Now, you know, to say, I mean, Titanic especially is one of those films that is like your Gone with the Winds and your Dr. Zhivago's, in that they are just like going to be remembered and watched for the rest of cinematic history. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think Titanic, and I haven't watched Titanic in probably a good 10 odd years, I don't think it's a particularly great movie. Like, I don't think Avatar is a particularly great movie. On a technical level, though, even though Cameron's got worse in terms of his ability to write, it seems, over the years, he's and some of his performances he can get, on a technical level, Titanic and Avatar are incredible achievements. And there's no taking away from that, really. Especially Avatar, especially. It's the one film, I think, that truly validates 3D. But except perhaps Toy Story 3, which was joyous.
Avatar just remains a tricky one, because for a large chunk of its runtime, it's essentially an animated movie. Yeah. There's no two ways of getting around it, really. You're basically just watching an entirely computer-generated movie for at least half of the running time of that. And as I said, as it all comes together, not only is it essentially beat-for-beat the story of Pocahontas, it riffs on too many other things from other James Cameron movies, and it ends up feeling the same problem that some people have had with Genesis. It feels like a greatest hits rather than Cameron taking this new idea he's had and doing something really different with it. It just feels like he created this technology, but then he didn't have a strong enough story to back it up. So we get this very, very, for all the inventive elements of it, this very derivative basic story that is full of all these really oddly sort of old-fashioned character moments. And that scene that you and I were laughing at when we went to see it, I remember, of when Michelle Rodriguez's helicopter gets shot down and she just kind of shrugs and says, "Oh, well, I'm going to die in a second, see ya."
Yeah, we were like,
it's just, yeah. It's a really oddly kind of disconnected film. Yeah. And I'm sure George Lucas would have had this issue. Anyone working in Sin City or any of the other Frank Miller movies or anything that's too much blue and green screen, because I suppose green screen is more accurate these days, there comes a point when you can only make people act to green for so far. And they if you're not putting them in enough practical stuff and giving them actual things to see and emote to and react from, it's like how Will Smith always describes his experience of making the Men in Black movies, is essentially having to stare down like a ping pong ball on the end of a stick and pretend it was a giant alien. Yeah. And how difficult it was sometimes to sort of click his imagination into doing that. There are only a few people who really... I think it's only really Sigourney Weaver and Zoe Saldana who come out of Avatar you know, still with their acting chops held up as a result of it.
But it just suggests that really Cameron's he's a lot more interested now in the technology and in the technical abilities of what film can do than the actual, you know, I mean, on the one hand, you know, I think he would still call himself a storyteller and things like that, but I'm not so sure he is. I think he's more an inventor now. But there's nothing to take away from the fact, you know, can't take away from the fact that he is pushing the boundaries of what film can do, you know, and he has been doing that for 30 years. So I think what he will be remembered for is, he'll be remembered for making some truly great films, I think more towards the beginning of his career, because by the look of it now, Avatar is pretty much going to be the rest of his career, I think. You know, it seems to be just all he's doing. He's making like another three films. He keeps pushing back when he's going to actually film them. So, you know, it's been nearly 10 years since getting on for nearly, you know, five. Well, yeah, I think it was 2009 Avatar. So it will be 10 years roughly. Yeah, it will be 10 years roughly before we probably see the next Avatar films. So, you know, well, from the first one. So like 2018, 2019. So it's like he's 60 now, so I think he's really going to spend most of the rest of his career dabbling in these kind of worlds where he's pushing, you know, the elements of what he can do with green screen, what he can do with 3D, what he can do with, you know, the next phase of technology. But even though his actual films, I mean, I'm not expecting much from the Avatar sequels really in terms of a storytelling level, but I think visually they will again be arresting, and I think they will push what he can do. Yeah, so the future of James Cameron will be very interesting. He, in fact, gave his a blessing of our final topic tonight, which is going back to Terminator, Terminator Genesis.
I look at each of you, and I see the marks of this long and terrible war. If we die tonight, mankind dies with us.
The machine sent a Terminator back to the time before the war to kill my mother, Sarah Connor.
Sir, let me save her. What you're doing right now, this is the end of the war.
Time you're going back to, she was scared and weak.
Take care of her for me, Kyle.
Come with me if you want to live.
Now, he called Terminator Genesis the spiritual T3, because in his mind, this is where the story should have gone after T2. Obviously, this is the new film that brings Arnold Schwarzenegger back into the role as the Terminator. Now he's back acting, playing again the T-800, only an older version, who's got older through his organic skin decaying over the ages of protecting Sarah Connor in an entirely new timeline, in which Jay Courtney's Kyle Reese flips back to, even on his original trajectory of being sent back by John Connor in the future, in 2029, as the first film does, ends up back in 1984, as the first film does, only Sarah Connor, played by the Khaleesi, the mother of dragons, Emilia Clarke, is now a badass, and she's being protected by a Terminator called Pops, who she considers like her father, and she's already on the hunt to try and stop Skynet. So you've got Kyle Reese going, what the fuck? You've got the audience going, what the fuck? And ultimately, what do we make of it? Is this the real comeback? Is this the spiritual sequel?
It's not a sequel. It's not a sequel in any way, because it starts with the conceit of the original film and then just goes off in its own new direction with it. It's not Terminator 3 at all. It's Terminator 1.5. Even it's you know, it's just a fresh start and a look back for it. Having heard the initial slightly negative reviews of it, I kind of went out and spoiled myself on it so that I could be a bit prepared for what was coming up. And this is what happens. Because we've now had the events of a Terminator arriving to protect Sarah in the 70s, that's created, imagine the chalkboard from Back to the Future 2, where the docs explain to Marty how they've speared off into the alternate 1985. That's exactly what's happened. And Kyle Reese has come back and along that timeline, because any changes earlier in the timeline, like at 73 and so on, have now created this new, slightly different reality, which again is why some of the things that happen in 2029 are different from what we're expecting, because, you know, as John says, this is where my information runs out. All these little tiny macro butterfly effect changes is what's creating this new version of events. So, not a sequel. You know, new timeline, new, completely different set of films. If you approach it with that mindset, then you're kind of like, right, fresh start, forget everything I knew about the other ones, let's go in and see what this one's going
to
do.
Well, that could serve to explain one of my biggest bugbears. I've got a couple of bugbears with this.
I think I can answer at least one of them, having thought about it, so let's see what you got.
Well, this one is, it's the whole thing. I've made this mistake when I've written scripts before, but there's a big moment in this that didn't make sense to me in terms of how the time works, in that the moment where John sends Kyle back is the moment, obviously, now spoilers, obviously, if you haven't seen this, but it's the moment where Matt Smith, who turns out obviously to be Skynet, attacks John Connor, and Kyle Reese sees this, and it causes him to, you know, partly end up in like this nexus point, which pushes him into this new timeline. The problem I had with that was, why didn't that happen originally? Now, maybe you've answered this question already in what you just said, mm-hmm. but why, if this is the exact same events that sent the original Kyle Reese back, why didn't that happen and in the first Terminator? But maybe your explanation there, in that it's kind of all feeding back into itself, that the original timeline that we saw in the 80s isn't the one that we've started on with Genesis, is why mm-hmm. in the original one film Kyle Reese didn't see that happen when he got back to 1984. That kind of does explain it, because that was something I came at the cinema going, well, that doesn't work. That's like one of those classic, oh well, you know, don't worry, it didn't happen in the first film, but it doesn't matter. Right, so
the Nexus point moment when Kyle's in the bubble and starts seeing, remembering the alternate timeline, it's because he's, as John says later in the film, you know, we're marooned, the three of us. John, because he's at the point of basically being sent back in time, he then starts seeing flashes of, because he's grown up post Judgment Day, but then because the date of Judgment Day moves because of the events that happen previously to it then going off, he then starts to remember two sets of memories, which is an event that the recent 12 Monkeys TV series played with a bit as well, and that John and that Carl starts to remember the future that they end up encountering him in as a younger lad later on, where he just has like a nice normal family life because Judgment Day hasn't happened yet. And the main question that I was asking at that point was, why did Skynet let Kyle get sent back in time? If it knew it had the ability to just wipe out everyone in the room and infect John Connor, why not do that? And this ties into my central thing that I think is going to answer one of your other points, in that Skynet had to let certain things happen because it had other things planned and going on that needed Kyle to go back to be there for, to like establish a timeline for, basically.
Possibly. My other bugbears, in a way, really aren't to do with the film itself. Because, I think this is better than Salvation, definitely. I think it's probably on a par in many respects with T3, actually. You know, it's got similar things. It's probably, I don't think it's got any action sequences that are as good as the big chase in T3. But I think
it is lacking a killer moment, isn't it?
It is. It's lacking that really memorable wow moment that the first three films do have in certain areas. But I think it's, you know, if it's not quite as good as T3, it's close. And I think it's got better actors in a lot of the parts than some of T3. I mean, Emilia Clarke's great as Sarah Connor. You know, she's as good as Linda Hamilton. She's as good as Lena Headey was in Sarah Connor Chronicles. Jay Courtney actually isn't kryptonite like normal. You know, he's awful normally, but he's actually quite good as Kyle Reese. I quite enjoyed
in that first corridor scene where him and John are just having a chat before they go on their last mission. I was like, oh god, he's so bad. But he does get a bit better as the film goes on. Something.
Yeah, he does. He is poor in that first scene, but he gets it. And he's got good chemistry with Emilia Clarke, and you know, I believe their relationship, and I liked that.
That's when he starts working. It's only when he's in scenes with her that he starts working really, because. True. You know, because he's suddenly not in charge of everything and he's having to take orders and just be blindly led around, and it suits him a lot better, I think, rather than being expected to be the guy in charge.
Yeah, and he becomes more sympathetic. And I've noticed when Jay Courtney plays a character who's not being a complete bellend, he's a lot more likeable, actually. He's not a great actor by any means, but he's all right in this. I quite enjoyed him. Then, you know, obviously Arnie's still being Arnie, really brilliant. He's got to the point now where he knows full well what he's doing. He's not quite parody, but he's, you know, he's very much with a twinkle in his eye and a little wink in many respects. You know, lines like, I'm old, not obsolete. You know, it's just pure, it's purely looking at Arnie and going, "Yeah, you're not quite past it yet, mate." It's great. You know, he's brilliant. He's great fun. And you know, so I've got no issue with any of that. I take issue. My biggest issue is not aimed actually at Alan Taylor, who directed it, who did a perfectly good job. Not aimed at the actors. Not the story has its issues and it has its problems, but it's the marketing that has really pissed me off, because it's basically this whole thing of how they ruined the central midpoint twist. And I remember when I saw this trailer, you and I spoke about this, and I said to you, in fact, I may have said it on a podcast, I'm convinced that the John Connor reveal that he's actually been turned into a Terminator will be at the middle of the film. And you were saying, well, you know, maybe it's an early twist and there'll be more afterwards, but no. And I hated the fact I was proven right, because I was in that cinema and I almost said, damn it, out loud, like really out loud, because I was just so furious that they would ruin. And in fact, Alan Taylor himself has come out and said that he can't fucking believe they did it, because there's a specific scene in Genesis where at one point John Connor's there and it seems like he's found his parents, and then Arnie shoots him, and it's this moment where you think, fuck, or you're supposed to think, fuck, is this Terminator really good? You know, is he actually bad? Is he actually suddenly going to turn? Is Arnie going to become bad for the rest of the film? But you don't think that, because if you've seen the trailer, you know exactly why he's doing it. The moment that John Connor returns, you know he's a Terminator. And I was just furious, because that could have been the most tense, exciting moment of this entire film, and it was ruined by moronic.
I know.
And I still am livid.
Knowing that going into it, you get a different sense. It's not as good, but you get the sense of dramatic irony, because as soon as John turns up, you know that he's a Terminator, but, you know, Sarah and Kyle don't, and it's only when Arnie wanders out and shoots him. The impact is massively lessened than what it could have been, and I share Alan Taylor's pain in that.
And the important thing is, that was not the creative intention at all behind that. That wasn't meant to be ironic. We weren't supposed to know at all. And that's
it baffles me why modern American marketing guys for films just keep making these trailers that spoil major plot points, as if they don't want to. I think they've got it into their heads that audiences don't like not knowing there's twists. They've got this weird perception that if they don't reveal a big twist, then the audience encounter it in the film, then people are going to be, you know, shocked by it.
It drove me mad. What it actually did was that it made me have a less goodwill towards the film, and that annoyed me, because I've been looking forward to this since they first announced it, and I was, you know, I've had my doubts, but having seen that trailer, I remember we were watching, you and I and a big bunch of our friends went to see Avengers Age of Ultron, and I'd heard that there was a big spoiler in the Terminator trailer, and I literally closed my eyes and covered my ears and shook in that seat trying not to hear or see that trailer, because I knew there was something in it. And everyone around me thought I was mental. I don't know if you saw this at this point. But they all thought I was crazy, but I was desperately trying to prevent myself from finding out what this was. And unfortunately, it didn't happen. And I was furious. I was absolutely furious, because it then made me angry at the point that I knew that I was going into this film. You know, I don't get me wrong. I'm sometimes a bit of a one for spoilers. You know, I mean, you know, I'm terrible at not keeping Game of Thrones secrets from people. I really am, right? But there are certain things that I just think, it's asinine. Why you think that it would be a good idea to piss your audience off before they go into your movie? And it could, in fact, account for the fact that Genesis is not doing very well. It's lagging behind Jurassic World and Inside
No.
Out. It is not making, the dent that they expected. And it will probably make its budget back, but not much more. So
I tell you why it's not doing very well. Well, two reasons, really. One, the screening that I went to see in yesterday, as people were, there was a bunch of older people getting up behind me in the seats who they were talking about just as the film was finishing. And one of the things I heard them said was, "They should just stick to the story with it, shouldn't they?" People were expecting it to be a remake of Terminator, and were annoyed that it wasn't. No, and I think that's the thing. Audiences have been, this marketing campaign has confused people into thinking they're basically going to see a remake of either Terminator or Terminator 2. Not its own thing, because again, they couldn't say too much about what was happening with it. And also, and this is the thing I thought you were going to mention about, there's a lot of stuff that happens in this film that isn't explained in this film, because this is part of a plan, you know, two or three films. There's a couple of massive plot points that don't get resolved in the movie, and you know me, ordinarily, it's like my whole bugbear with Prometheus and just the absolute shipwreck that turns into in the last half hour of just setting all this stuff up and not bothering to explain it. They do at least acknowledge in the film that there's still some stuff that they don't know about, and I think that's what people got upset with, because I thought the other bugbear you were going to say to me was, who sent the Terminator back to 73? Who sent both of them back to 73? Well, and who sent the T-1000 to 84 ready for Kyle Reese to come out?
Those are questions that
And the answer is, this is it, and the answer is, it's we're going to find that out if they get to the next film. Because why did Skynet still allow Kyle to go back in time when he could have killed them all at any time? It's because, for whatever reason, after we see that moment where John gets assimilated and borged by the Skynet virus, presumably that's when they start, or maybe even it's happened before that point. I don't know yet. It's quite fun in a way, because they've got to find out a way of explaining it. But at some point, a T-1000 gets sent back to kill Sarah Connor when she's 9. And the Resistance reprogram the T-800 pops and send him back to protect her. And he stays there with her from that point onwards. But that's happened at a point in which the other characters, up to that point in the future, didn't know about. So something else is going to happen, because those same people presumably also sent the T-1000 ready to kill Kyle Reese when he came out, because no one knew that was going to happen either. So it's either going to completely fall apart, or they've got this actually very clever narrative laid out, but it does need two films to tell it properly. And I think a lot of people maybe didn't get that about it. I mean, I dare say only the fact that I was reading up on the spoilers about it and trying to get ahead of the game in it, I was expecting this going in, so I had time before the end of the film to have figured this answer out. Had I just seen it on its own merits, I probably would have come out saying that made no fucking sense, that was the worst film ever. And I think that's what a lot of people are coming out saying.
I think possibly, and they don't know as well that this has been planned as a trilogy from the get-go, because now Skydance Productions have the entire rights to the entire Terminator franchise in-house, so they can now plan long-term. You know, there's associated TV series being developed, and it's going to become a big franchise now, potentially, if it makes its money. You know, and so we'll see, really, and because they definitely have a 3-film plan for this iteration, and that's why it ends very much teeing up, you know, these Kyle, Sarah, and you know, Arnie off on their jollies.
Taking the whole film to get Kyle and Sarah together, I'm like, good. I approved of that, because I thought that was handled really nicely, in that she thinks she's trained herself to not fancy him on principle at first, and she gradually comes to like him over the course of the film, whereas he's been in love with this one little willowy sort of vulnerable flower version of her that he's heard about, and then he meets this new alternate version of her, and it takes him a while to get round to that as well. But also the fact that Arnie's been upgraded now, basically the T-800 chip is now in a T-1000 body. So, you know, there's some nice potential there for them to do some interesting things with that. And presumably Skynet, given that Skynet has survived.
But yeah, I don't think it was a bad film. It was more the marketing that annoyed me than the film itself. I think the film does things perfectly well. It does become a big shouty action load of nonsense, really, and it loses, it's not much more than that, really. But it does have some interesting ideas, and I think I would go and see another one with that cast, and you know, it could develop from there. And I think it will. I think if it makes its money, there'll be plenty more Terminator to come. And given it's, you know, it's a good franchise, it's got a great mythology, it's got a great idea, you know, I will always be glad if it's hanging around, really. We will see. We'll see in 2017 is destined to be the next one. So we'll see then. I'm sure we'll be back to review it in that future time. So thanks, Lee. It's been really good to hack through the Terminator films with you this evening.
Well, it's an opportunity to just sort of gabble about them. It's one of those many things that I didn't realise that I knew as well as I did until I started talking about it, and then suddenly realised I actually knew like a ton more than I'd consciously been aware of about the films.
It is one of those franchises, really, isn't it? Yeah, do you want to just share a little bit about where we can find you online, your Zero Geek website, maybe?
Yeah, so it's @zero_geek on Twitter. It's just me rambling about video games and stuff, and also you can get Zero Geek on Facebook. The updates are perhaps not as regular as I'd like them to be at the moment, but I'm in the works of putting together a proper blog and a website so I can voice my various opinions about the state of play on gamings and things. As anyone who's been listening to me over this can probably imagine, I will be kind of rambling on all kinds of things at various length, but I'm always very interesting, and if nothing else, then I, you know, just try to say something different to what everyone else has been saying, hence me being the guy tonight putting my hand up and saying Terminator Salvation is actually an alright movie, you guys, maybe you should go and watch it. Yeah. Whether anyone listens to me or not is another story, but we will see from there.
You put your head above the parapet there, you did, yeah, brave. Do check out Zero Geek, it's a great website, there's some really good articles, it's sporadic, but it's some really good articles when Lee gets the time, so do check it out. As for Black Hole Cinema, obviously you can find us on Twitter at Black Hole Cinema, as ever. I have just today launched the blog, the accompanying blog, which is long in the making. This is called Black Hole Online, which will basically involve features, news, reviews of the films I watch, and hopefully it will be co-curated by some of my other hosts and guests. It's an open invitation for anyone who's appeared on Black Hole Cinema to write some articles and some reviews and things like that, so hopefully we'll get a bit of content on there pretty fast, so keep an eye out for that. It's currently you can find it at www.blackholeonline.wordpress.com, and eventually it will get its own domain, so it's early days, but it'll be nice to get that on there. So yeah, we'll be back next week, in which Dan Taylor will be back hosting with a few guests to talk about the potentially divisive Ted 2. So yeah, it's goodbye from Lee.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from me. See you later.
I'll be back.